everybody. My name is Olivia Friedman, and I teach at Ida Crown, and I'm really excited to get to be here with you today. I'm sorry about the lack of handouts. I am excited all of you are here. So today we will be discussing the battle between love and duty. And I'm going to start with a quote from Shir HaShirim, which is source one, and this is what it says. It says, "Simeni kachotam al libecha, kachotam al zro'echa, ki aza chamavas ahava. Kasha kishol kina, rishafeha rishpe esh shalhavateha." So let me be a seal upon your heart, like the seal upon your hand. For love is fierce as death, passion is mighty as Sheol, its darts are darts of fire, a blazing flame. So from here we see that love is pretty intense. It's a strong emotion, it can make people do incredible things. And on the flip side of that, when you think about duty and obligation, that's also very strong, and that can also make people do important and impressive and difficult things. And so what happens is sometimes we have situations where those two things clash. And the people that we love will put us at odds with the obligations or duties that we might have, whether that's an obligation or duty to God, whether that's an obligation or duty to the realm, if we're in a fictional universe where your decisions will impact the good of the realm or the universe or whatever it may be. So I like to bring in some pop culture. You don't need to understand the pop culture. For those of you who enjoy it, you enjoy it. For those of you who it goes over your head, that's fine. There's a book series called A Song of Ice and Fire, and it's written by someone called George R.R. Martin, and it's become quite popular. And so I have here in Source 2 a brief overview of what exactly that book series is. So it's an epic fantasy book series. It's based in large part on history, especially the Wars of the Roses. It focuses on a continent called Westeros. There's also this landmass called Essos. Westeros is comprised of seven territories that were originally independent kingdoms, each of which still has a leader, a house, bannermen, and so on. And at the beginning of the series, all of Westeros is ruled by King Robert, who sits on something called the Iron Throne. So they're all united. But the Iron Throne originally belonged to the Targaryen family. King Robert is only there because the former king was assassinated. Aerys Targaryen had two children who managed to flee before Robert took power. And then the series follows these threads. One, there's a dynastic war of succession for the Iron Throne. Who in the end will seize all the power? Who's going to sit on the Iron Throne by any means necessary? There are people who play fair and who are very honorable and noble, and there's people who are very cruel and who are, you know, they lust after power. They're not interested in playing fair. All right, you have also the Targaryen children are attempting to return from exile and reclaim the throne, and you have the threat of the others, which are these supernatural beings that are contained by the wall. Okay. In Westeros itself, you also have in all of these places that originally existed as seven independent kingdoms, people who still live there, and all of them have what are called houses, and all of them have words. And so if you're interested, you can read through them. You know, the North is ruled by House Stark, and their words are winter is coming, the Vale is ruled by House Arryn, so on and so forth. Why do we care about any of this? Because what this book series did is it popularized this essential question of what do I do when I'm faced with a conflict between love and duty? What's my response to that? How should I choose in that situation? And a lot of people the world over are very caught up in this question currently because this became such a phenomenon. And what I want to show all of you is that that's not a new question. This is a question that we have had since time immemorial, and our sources, especially in the Tanakh, really engage very deeply with that question. And we see people all over the place who are trying to determine what should I do. And so I have a couple of quotes that, you know, link it back to the pop culture references, and then we'll be done with that piece, and we'll focus on the Judaic pieces. So turning on over to Source 3, we have a dialogue between Maester Aemon. Maester is the equivalent of this, like, grandmaster, wizard, very knowledgeable person, and this person called Jon. And Jon is from House Stark, but he's actually, his last name is Snow, he's considered to be illegitimate, and he's been sent to something called the Night's Watch. And the Night's Watch, unlike these other feuding kingdoms where everyone is trying to figure out who's going to sit on the Iron Throne, they're supposed to be removed from all of that. They're supposed to be only focused on the good of the realm as a whole. So that's John's job, right? John is supposed to care about duty and obligation, not so much about love. So here comes this dialogue. Maester Aemon says, "Tell me, did you ever wonder why the men of the Night's Watch take no wives and father no children?" And John says, "No." So Maester Aemon says, "So they will not love. Love is the death of duty. If the day should ever come when your lord father was forced to choose between honor on the one hand and those he loves on the other, what would he do?" And so John replies, "He would do whatever was right, no matter what." So Maester Aemon says, "Then Lord Stark is one man in 10,000. Most of us are not so strong. What is honor compared to a woman's love? What is duty against the feel of a newborn son in your arms or a brother's smile? We're all human. Oh, we all do our duty when there's no cost to it. Honor comes easily then. Yet sooner or later, in every man's life, there comes a day when it is not easy. A day when he must choose." And that's what we're focusing on today. The day when he must choose. What happens when these two things are in conflict with each other? How do people choose? Do they choose correctly? How do we even know if there is one correct way to choose? All right. Later on, John comes to a situation where he has the flip side of this, the inverse, where he experiences that duty is the death of love. There's a character called Tyrion, and Tyrion says, "Sometimes duty is the death of love. You are the shield that guards the realms of men. You've always tried to do the right thing, no matter the cost. You've tried to protect people. Who is the greatest threat to the people now? It's a terrible thing I'm asking. It's also the right thing." So what we're going to do is look at several different narratives in the Tanakh where people struggle with this choice, and we're going to look at how they choose, why they choose that way, and then bring it back to us in terms of how does this relate to us, because most of us are not kings or emperors, but I think that the message will still resonate. So narrative number one, I'm on source 5 and 6, is the famous story of Avraham and Yitzhak. And this is probably the first thing that comes to people's minds when you consider this struggle. Right, you have the story in Bereishit, and so after some things happen, God puts Avraham to the test, and he says to him, "Avraham," and Avraham answers, "Hineni." Vayomer kachna et bincha et yechidcha asher ahavta et Yitzchak velech lecha al eretz hamoria v'ha'alehu sham le'ola al achad haharim asher omar ilecha. Take your son, your favored one, Yitzchak, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as an offering on one of the heights that I will point out to you. So, we need to remember context for this story, in that what has happened before this is that Abraham just had to kick out Hagar and Ishmael because Sarah was not fans of theirs. And that was a difficult thing for him. He didn't want to do that. He didn't feel emotionally okay about it. We see it in the Psukim. He says to Hashem, "I wish that Ishmael could live before you. You know, I wish that things would be okay between you and him." And God basically says to him, "You need to listen to your wife." And so he's sent away Ishmael. And now he's being asked, after he did this difficult thing and parted from his wife and son, to offer up Yitzchak as well. And this is the child that he waited for, the one that they struggled for. So it's not just any child, although obviously offering up any child would have been hard enough. But this is the child, the much longed for child. And so what God is asking him to do places him squarely between that place of love or duty, right? Love for one's child and duty and obligation to God. And what should he do? How should he determine? So as we know, the story goes onward. Avraham goes with Yitzchak. There's a variety of different ways to read the story. Depends if you're reading it with Rashi, the Medrash, you know, other people, Kierkegaard, you know, we could go on and on. So I'm not going to get into every single way of reading it. But we're going to focus on the end result. So the end result is that Avraham, you know, there's an important pasuk that says that the two of them walk together. I just want to point that out, where it says, the two of them walk together. That's a part of some of the interpretations that say that Yitzchak did have some choice in this and he decided to go willingly. But anyway, they come to the place where God had told him. Avraham builds the altar there. He lays out the wood. He binds his son. He puts him on the altar. He picks up the knife. And then an angel says, "Avraham," right? And he stops him. He says, "Al tishlach yadcha al hana'ar ve'al ta'aslo me'uma ki ata yadati ki yarei Elokim ata." All right, so don't do anything to him. The fact that you were willing to make this choice and do this thing has demonstrated your faith and love and respect for me. Just to make things more interesting, there comes this midrash, the Midrash Tanhuma, that says that aside from the narrative that we read in the Psukim, there was another struggle that was going on in Avraham's attempt to fulfill this very, very difficult mitzvah, where Satan, the adversary, appears before him, and he's dressed in the disguise of an old man. This is source 7, for those of you who want to follow with me. And he says to Avraham, where are you going? Avraham says, to pray. So Satan says back to him, why are you going to pray with a knife in your hands? So Avraham's like, well, you know, I'm going to have to go to this place. Maybe I'll slaughter an animal there. Satan says, I know that's not true. I was present when the Holy One ordered you to take your son. Why should an old man who begets a son at the age of 100 destroy him? Have you not heard the parable of the man who destroyed his own possessions and was forced to beg from others? If you believe that you will have another son, you're listening to the words of a seducer. And if you destroy his soul, you'll be held accountable for it. Avraham said, it wasn't, you know, some kind of seducer. It wasn't some kind of evil angel. It was God who told me what I must do, and I'm not going to listen to you. And then Satan tries to persuade Yitzchak as well, and basically this heightens the drama of the story. It's no longer just that you have this man and his son going along, but they actually have a face-off with the Satan now, and he continues and persists, despite the Satan making very logical arguments that I think all of us would agree with. You know, he persists anyway, and he goes up to offer his child. So Rabbi Soloveitchik in source 8 deals with, you know, how could Avraham have done this? This seems inhuman. It's very difficult to understand. And like I said, there's a variety of answers. So if this one doesn't speak to you personally, don't worry. There's others out there. This is the one I chose for today. And so he talked about prayer. He talks about how prayer to him means to surrender one's pride and self-confidence, put aside any awareness of greatness, freedom, and independence. It's for people who are capable of complete surrender. And he compares it to a child. He says the child feels that he's in the embrace of someone who loves him very much, who will protect him, do anything to make his life happy and better. That feeling is the root of prayer. So he says, emunah sometimes confronts us with a challenge to suspend our judgment, to act irrationally, to act illogically, to act even though we don't understand why we're acting a certain way. And skipping down to the bolded part, when it comes to Avraham, he doesn't say a word, he doesn't complain, he accepts God's command. An adult could not do that. Only a child is capable of absolute unconditional surrender to the point of giving up one's humanity and one's conscience. And flipping on over to its page 8, and also source 9, we have that Avraham was an intellectual giant. He wasn't a child, but he was capable of transforming himself into a child, accepting the Almighty's command to suspend his judgment and his humanity. So what Avraham does here, he does something incredibly difficult. He puts his obligation and to some degree love of God, because those two things are mixed, over his love for his child. He's willing to do this, and he's willing to kind of surrender his personal judgments and his views to God. Yes?
Well, this is really remarkable. Some time ago, quite a while ago, I read a piece about the Akedah. And in that piece, the individual wrote that after the Akedah, the text doesn't say again, et bincha asher ahavta. Asher ahavta is removed. It's just et bincha, et yichidcha, et yitzchak, but not asher ahavta.
That's interesting.
I never went back to see if that's true. I was curious, could it be? But that's what this individual stated, that the Tanakh doesn't say, the Chumash doesn't say after that, asher ahavta. That he put love aside.
He set it aside for the sake of... And that's possible. I would have to have a Tanakh in front of me. That's very possible that that is so. It's definitely true that their relationship transforms from there in various ways, and that there's also different interpretations of what exactly happens. Yitzchak doesn't seem to come home immediately afterwards to Sarah. Where was he? There's a view that he was in a yeshiva, whatever that means. There's another really interesting view way before the whole Jesus crucifixion idea that to some extent he actually dies and then is resurrected. So this is not necessarily the most mainstream, but there's very, very interesting stuff going on, and definitely there's a lot to be said, and we could do a whole bunch of shiurim just on the Akedah. But I only want to bring it up today to focus on the love versus obligation angle, with the understanding there's a lot more to be said. I'm going to move to a different narrative now. This is the narrative of King David, his son Amnon, and his other son Avshalom. And so we are on page 8, and we are on source 10. And I'm going to summarize source 10 for you. Here's what's happening. So Avshalom, the son of David, has a beautiful sister whose name is Tamar. Amnon, who's another son of David, but not by the same mother, becomes infatuated with her. Amnon actually becomes heartsick because of his infatuation, And there's this guy named Yonadav, who's actually a relative of all of them, and he is very clever, and he goes, "Why are you so dejected, Prince? What's going on?" And Amnon says, "Well, I'm in love with Tamar, the sister of my brother Avshalom." Yonadav gives him a plan of how he could get Tamar to fall into his clutches. He says, "You know, lie down in your bed, pretend you're sick. When your father comes to see you, tell him, let my sister Tamar come and make something for me to eat. She'll prepare the food in front of me. Maybe that will give me an appetite. I'll eat it." Okay. So Dovid asks Tamar to do this, thinking that he's helping his son Amnon get better. And then we get to this, you know, horrific change of scene for those of us who don't know what's coming, where Amnon asks Tamar to feed him, and you think that this is this loving, brotherly, sisterly interaction where she's trying to help him feel better, but he catches hold of her, and he says, "Come lie with me, sister." And she says, "Don't, brother, don't force me. These things are not done in Israel. This is vile. Where would I carry my shame?" And, you know, she comes up with this other approach that maybe you should speak to the king. He's not interested. He decides to force her. He rapes her. And after he does that, he discards her. He tells his servants to throw it out. The language is it. Throw it out of the room and bolt the door. And so this is this horrific, horrific thing that happens to Tamar. And she is wearing this beautiful coat of many colors, which is similar to the Yosef coat. We have a similar language, which the virgins used to wear to indicate their virginal status. She rips it. She puts like ashes and dirt on her head. She walks around wailing. And her brother Avshalom finds her, and he says, "Okay, hold your peace for right now." Now, why does he say hold your peace? The way that I read the story, the pshat of the story, seems to me like the reason he's telling her to hold your peace is because Avshalom assumes Dovid will do something, because that would be the logical thing to have happen here, right? Yes, you have one child who has harmed the other child. They are both your blood. They are both your children, but you still need to intervene in whatever capacity. Perhaps you have to intervene in your capacity as a king versus your capacity as a father. But if you look at the Hebrew, I'm on page 9, and this is the end of source 10, you see, V'hamelach David shama et kol hadvarim ha'ela v'ichar lo me'od. When King David heard about all of this, he was greatly upset. And that's it. He's upset, but he doesn't do anything. He doesn't, I don't know, whatever could be done. He doesn't kill Amnon. He doesn't put Amnon under house arrest. He doesn't, you know, force him to marry Tamar, which nowadays would be repugnant to all of us. But in those times, after the woman's virginity had been lost, to some women that was a comfort, that at least they had a husband. You know, he doesn't do anything. And so if you look at the next page, you look at source 11, the Malbim comments to this, right? V'hamelech David chara lo ma'od. David was very angry. Ulam lo hochicho al zeh v'chol zeh orer sinat Avshalom. He doesn't rebuke Amnon on this matter, and all of that is what awakens the hatred of Avshalom. Because Avshalom is waiting. He's waiting. What's my father going to do? What's David going to do? And then David doesn't do anything. So why doesn't he do anything? If you look at source 12, there's one approach that's offered by Rav Amnon Bazak. And he says, he hears about the incidents. The matter infuriates him, but he can't say a word to Amnon for two reasons. First of all, he can't level charges against Amnon, because if he were to say to him, "Remove the chip from between your teeth," he would lash back and say, "Remove the beam from between your eyes." What does that mean? Amnon would remind him of his part in the Bathsheba affair. You summoned Bathsheba to your house, and you slept with her, so you're going to really rebuke me about like what I'm doing sexually with my sister? Like, why should I take it from you? Second, this is an expression of a broader phenomenon. From the end of the Bathsheba affair, David no longer functioned as a king who enjoyed authority. That's one view. I'm going to quote the Septuagint to you. That's source 13. In the Septuagint, you have King David heard all of these things. He was very angry, but he did not grieve the spirit of his son Amnon because he loved him, for he was his firstborn. So I want to suggest that actually what's going on here is that we go back to this love versus obligation scenario. You love your children. You always will, no matter how they behave, right? We have stories. Andrew Solomon has this really interesting book called Far From the Tree, where he goes through all kinds of parents and children where they're not the same, which includes stories of people where their children become criminals or their children become rapists or things like that, and like, how do the parents respond to that? And there's all kinds of responses, but most of them revolve parents who love their kids regardless, but who can't accept what their kids have done. So going back here, You know, he loves him and he doesn't stop him. I think that there's a lot more to that that has to do with understanding David as a character better, David's own backstory, David's role models or lack thereof, of why he felt it was so important to give unconditional love to his children, unconditional love that eventually damages his children because he doesn't rebuke them. But I think that we can read, there is a way to read David in a sympathetic light if you look at his whole story. But the point remains that what happens is that Avshalom takes the law into his own hands. He arranges something which is the prototype for a scene that's called the Red Wedding that happens in the Song of Ice and Fire. Before there was a Red Wedding, there was Avshalom's shearing party. So there's the shearing party, and what happens is he kills Amnon there. He flees, and David is stuck. Because he has the one son who raped the daughter, who's now been murdered by the other son, and the other son has escaped, and what does he do? How does he get out of this complicated situation? So we're on source 14, and at first King David mourns over his son a long time, but then King David was pining away for Absalom because the king had gotten over Amnon's death. But what should he do? Like, can he really call him back? He murdered his brother. So Yoav, who's David's general, figures out that the king is focused on Avshalom. We're on source 15. Vayeda Yoav ben Tzeruya ki lev hamelech al Avshalom. And he brings a wise woman, right? This wise woman from Tekoa, Isha Chachama. When I was learning the Tanakh and I learned this story, I was like, this is who I want to be. I like this Isha Chachama. She's so clever. Look what she does. This is what she does. She comes and she puts on an act. She is an actress. And she acts out a story, which is a parable for David of what he is experiencing. She pretends she's bringing a court case. It's very dramatic. So Yoav says to her, listen, you pretend you're in mourning. Put on your mourning clothes. Don't anoint yourself with oil. Look like someone who's grieved a long time. Go to the king and tell him this and this. So she goes. What does she say? I'm a widow. My husband is dead. I had two sons. They came to blows out in the field. One killed the other. And then everyone said, hand over the one who killed his brother. But if I do that, they would quench the last ember remaining to me and leave my husband without name or remnant upon the earth. Now, obviously this is not literally true of David. David has many children. So this isn't going to be the last child, like that if Avshalom was to be put to death or something, it wouldn't be that he has no other progeny. But I think it's a clue to how David feels, because David actually cares about Avshalom. He loves Avshalom. And so Yoav latches onto that, which is how he gets to this whole psychological experiment. And in the end, David says to Yoav, okay, bring back Avshalom. But here's the interesting thing. He puts limits on it. We're on source 16. The king says, let him go directly to his house and not present himself to me. So Avshalom went directly to his house and he didn't present himself to the king. Then we get to source 17. Avshalom lived in Yerushalayim for 2 years without appearing before the king. So imagine this drama. Here's Avshalom who feels wronged because he feels like, what did I do already? I protected my sister who was horribly raped after we waited for you to make a judgment and you chose not to make any judgment. And now you have finally decided that you can pardon me enough that I can come back home, but you won't see me. I'm not allowed to see you. I'm not allowed to come to the court. And I've been patient. I waited 2 years. You're still not seeing me. So he sent for Yoav, because Yoav was the one who figured it out the last time. And he says, listen, figure out a way for me to see my father. Yoav won't come. He sends him again. Yoav still won't come. So Avshalom says, listen, go set Yoav's fields on fire. Because that's going to get his attention. And maybe then he'll listen to me. So he does that, and Yoav comes at once to Avshalom's house. And he goes, why did you set my fields on fire? And Avshalom says, I wanted you to come. I wanted to send you to the king to say, why did I leave Geshur? I would be better off if I were still there. Now let me appear before the king, and if I am guilty of anything, let him put me to death. So the Hebrew is, right? And so, eventually, Yoav goes to the king, speaks these words, he comes to the king, and the king kisses Avshalom. Okay, you may think from reading the Pshat that everything is solved, right? The king has summoned him, he kissed him, but no. I want you to pay attention to the Hebrew, because I think it's important, because it echoes a scene that David had in his own life when he was younger. Here's the scene. David was dealing with Shaul, who wanted to kill him. And he went to Yonatan, and he basically said, why is your father trying to kill me? And so he says to Yonatan the following thing. V'yasita chesed al avdecha ki bivrit Hashem hiveta et avdecha imach v'im yesh bi avon hemiteni ata v'aravicha lama zet v'yeni. If I'm guilty, kill me yourself. He says that to Yonatan, who he loves. Okay, this is source 18. Much later on, they have this whole plan. You guys hear it when we read the Haftorah having to do with the new moon. And so what happens is that David eventually realizes, and Yonatan realizes, Shaul's not going to change his mind. David has to run away. And they kiss each other. Look at the Hebrew. Vayishku ish et re'ehu, vayivku ish et re'ehu. Each man kisses the other. They weep together. Okay, so pasuk yud tet. So here's what I would like to suggest. When Yoav repeats over to David, the wording that Avshalom uses, the wording of, right, Lama bati migashur tov li od anisham, v'ata ara p'nei hamelech, v'im yesh bi avon v'hemiteni, it jerks something loose in David. He's like, oh my God, I used that wording myself. I used it to Yonatan about Shaul. Like, I can't be this person. So he allows his son to come. But he still can't fully forgive his son because his son did murder his brother. And so you have a very huge difference in the two scenes with the kissing, in that the kissing he gives Yonatan, they're parting ways, it's full of emotion. You would expect that if Avshalom is really being welcomed back into the presence of the king and he loves him and so on, you know, think about Yaakov meeting Yosef. They fall upon each other's neck, they cry, they kiss. It doesn't happen here. Yeah.
But this is the last time that that David sees Yonatan. It's like a kiss, a farewell. He doesn't know it at the time.
True.
Is he deliberately kissing Avshalom as a kiss of farewell later on?
No. So he's not, but I wanted to just compare like kisses where there's love involved versus kisses that are more cold. This is a much colder kiss. He kisses him, but it's not, and perhaps the better comparison is, you know, Yaakov and Yosef, because that's a father and son being reunited. And think about the emotion that's involved there versus what's going on here. And this is not my own idea. The Malbim says this. If you look at the Malbim in source 20, and look at the Hebrew, Vayishak HaMelech li Avshalom. The king kissed to Avshalom. So, Gam bazeh hareh shelo yamichuhu. He shows him he's not going to make him king. Shekvar katav Ibn Ezra b'parsha toldot sheneshika im lamed hu biyad o beketef u beli lamed hu bepeh. So basically, there's different kinds of kisses, and the way that this is worded, the king kissed to Avshalom, think of it as maybe a kiss on the hand, a kiss on the forehead. This is not like a loving kiss. You're welcome back into my court, into my good graces, and you will become the next in line to rule. That's not what this is. So he's welcomed, but he's not. And so it's hard because they love each other, and yet, you know, David can't let go of the fact, perhaps rightfully so, that, you know, Avshalom killed Amnon, and Avshalom can't let go of the fact that you didn't do anything to defend my sister. So they love each other, but they're angry with each other. What does this lead to? It leads to, in source 21, Avshalom making a rebellion, and look at his rebellion. Look at what he says. Right, he says to people, "Vayomri lav Avshalom, re'ei dvaracha tovim u'nechachim, v'shomea ein lecha meit hamelech." So he says, you know, it's clear that your claim when it comes to court cases is right and just, but there's no one assigned to hear it from the king. But if I were king, right, in Pasuk Dalet, if I were the shofet ba'aretz, then alayavu kol ish asher yiyah lo riv u'mishpat v'hitzaktiv. I would see that people got justice. Well, where is that coming from? That's coming from his own experience. He didn't get justice for Tamar, and Tamar didn't get justice. So when he makes a rebellion against his father, it's not just a spiteful boy who decides, I want power. It's someone who feels like there has been this terrible miscarriage of justice. I'm the only one who can give justice in the realm. My father doesn't see it that way. He hasn't forgiven me. He hasn't assigned me to be the next in line to rule. I have to be the one to take it. So that's what he does. And that's different, by the way, from the rebellion that some of you may be familiar with later on, the rebellion of Adoniyahu. There are some parallels, but this important thing that Avshalom does to win the hearts of Israel is completely missing. And I think that's because Avshalom has a personal reason behind why he rebels that Adoniyahu does not. Okay, so what happens? Here's what happens next. We get to sources 22, 23, 24. There's this advisor called Achitofel. Achitofel is basically a brilliant genius. His advice cannot go wrong. When David finds out that Achitofel has defected to Avshalom's side, he actually davens to Hashem that Avshalom should not listen to Achitofel, and they send in this other person, Hushai, and they're like hoping that Hushai can give different advice and that Avshalom will listen to Hushai's advice instead. Because if it was Achitophel, then they're in trouble. Yeah.
Is Achitophel Bathsheba's grandfather?
Yes. There is an interpretation
that
says so.
He also feels that what David did to Bathsheba was wrong and no justice was given.
Potentially.
So that's why he's giving this advice to Avshalom.
Yes, there's at least one interpretation that could go with that. There's other interpretations that view him as more like power hungry, but yes, that is one reading for sure. So Achitophel says to Avshalom in source 22, "You need to go have intercourse with your father's concubines, whom he left to mind the palace, and when all of Israel sees that you've done that, they'll support you." This seems super weird. What does sleeping with concubines have to do with anything? Why is that a military strategy? What's going on? So Rashi says, in source 23, "You'll strengthen the hands of all those who are with you, because at present they think maybe the son and the father will reconcile. But after you take an action like this, where you actually sleep with your father's concubines, they'll be like, there's no coming back from that. There's no reconciliation possible, so we might as well throw our lot in with Avshalom, because this is going to end. One of them is going to die. Like, there's no way for this to end peacefully." The Malbim is even more specific. The Malbim says the following thing in source 24. "Why in the world would David, who's fleeing for his life with all of his people, leave concubines in the palace?" You know, and that shows that David does not actually think of Avshalom as a true enemy. Because if he really thought of him as an enemy, he wouldn't do that. He would be too afraid. A real enemy would maybe slaughter the women, rape the women, but he doesn't think of his son like that. He thinks of him as his son, which shows you that there is still love involved here, that David loves him even though he can't make him crown prince. He loves him, and he doesn't know what to do with that. And so according to the Malbim, source 24, you get, and 25, Achitophel's initial desire was to give advice, kill your father. But he figured that's a little bit harsh. Can't start there. So step one, go sleep with all your father's women. Step two, then kill your father. After you've done this act that will make it, you'll be unable to reconcile with him, and it will turn you into thinking of him as an enemy rather than thinking of him the way a son thinks of a father, the way a father thinks of a son. And he lays that out in source 25. So then, in exactly that way, in source 26, Achitophel tells Avshalom, "Let me pick 12,000 men. I'll set out tonight in pursuit of David. I'll come upon him when he's weary and disheartened. I will kill the king alone. And I'll bring back all the people to you." Here's what I think is very interesting about this. When Achitophel gives this advice, he leaves Avshalom out of it completely. You know why he does that? Because Avshalom still cares about his father, and if Avshalom were to come with him, there's no way of knowing that Avshalom would actually kill the king. But I will kill the king alone. I, Achitophel, I with my troops, I can get this done for you. That is the intelligent advice to follow here, right? And if you look at this, it says, "Vayishar hadavar be'enei Avshalom uve'enei kol ziknei Yisrael." The advice was straightforward in the eyes of Avshalom and all the elders of Israel. Look at the Malbim again. "Vayishar hadavar lo katav vayitav hadavar ki be'emet haya davar ze ra be'eneihem laharogat hamelech rak shematzu shehi itza yashra." So it was straightforward in their eyes, but it wasn't good. They didn't actually want to do it. They didn't really want to kill the king. And that's why Avshalom calls Hushai. What ends up getting Avshalom in trouble is that he listens to Hushai over Achitophel. The reason he calls Hushai is because he still loves his father, and he doesn't really want to follow Achitophel's advice. And that's what I'm saying. This whole entire story of Avshalom and David is this humongous tragedy, because David loves Avshalom. Avshalom loves David. Because of the fact that David didn't do anything in the Amnon situation, that is what has led to this entire mess. That is even what has led to Avshalom seizing power. And like, that's why they're all caught up in it. And it's just, the whole thing is sad. Like, it's sad. It's not just, you know, I want power, I'll be king. It's like, this is a tragedy that is occurring. So now we get to what happens now. Avshalom chooses to follow Hushai's advice, where he himself goes out to the battle, and they go out a day later. And so the king gives orders to his general. David says to Yoav in source 28, "V'yeti tai limor la'at li la'na'ar la'avshalom. Deal gently with the boy for my sake." And Radak says, "Deal gently with the boy for my sake. If you meet him in battle, deal gently with him for my sake. I don't want to see his evil end. Even though he acted badly to me, I am his father who feels mercy towards him." Okay, what ends up happening? A man comes and tells Yoav in source 30, "I just saw Avshalom caught by his hair and hanging." Yoav says to him, "You saw it? Why didn't you kill him then and there?" I would have owed you 10 shekels and a belt. And the man goes, listen, even if I got 1,000 shekels, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. I saw what he said to you. He said to you to deal gently with him. So Yoav says, I will not wait for you. He takes 3 darts in his hand. He drives them into Avshalom's chest. And then 10 of Yoav's young armor bearers close in and strike at Avshalom until he dies. David finds out about all of this. Source 32. The king is shaken. He goes up to the upper chamber of the gateway and he moans and he weeps these words. He says, Bini Avshalom, Bini, Bini Avshalom, Mi Yitin Muti, Ani Tachtacha, Avshalom, Bini, Bini. My son Avshalom, oh my son Avshalom, if only I had died instead of you, oh Avshalom, my son, my son. And Yoav is informed of this, that the king is weeping and mourning over Avshalom. And so Yoav comes to him and he says something very important for our central question about love versus obligation. And this is what he says, it's the bolded part. Hovashta hayom et pnei kol avadecha hamemaltim et nafshecha hayom v'et nefesh benecha uvenotecha v'nefesh nashecha v'nefesh pilakshecha la'ahava et zonecha v'lisno et ohavecha ki at ki higadeta hayom ki ein lecha sarim v'avadim ki yadati hayom ki luav shalom chai v'chulanu hayom etim ki az yashar v'einecha. He says something very, very powerful. Today, you have humiliated all your followers who this day saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines by showing love for those who hate you and hate for those who love you. For you have made clear today that the officers and men mean nothing to you. I am sure that if Avshalom were alive today and the rest of us dead, you would have preferred it. Now that's super harsh, but you have to remember that Yoav is a general, and he has to be concerned about all the political implications of everything David is doing. And what he's doing is the equivalent of, David, snap out of this. You cannot do this now. You can't mourn. Even if you feel that way, you're going to lose the people if you do this. So in David's story, when we get to the choice between love and obligation, David chooses love. Yoav chooses obligation. You know, Yoav is the one who decides to act upon the fact that the duty to the realm is to have a united kingdom, and the united kingdom should be under David, and we can't suffer the fact that people are having rebellions, and he's the one who kills Avshalom. But David, in his capacity as a father, chooses love. That's what leads him to the mess. He chooses love for Amnon. He chooses love for Avshalom. And he chooses love over duty and obligation, and we understand why. We get why he does these things, even though we also see the mess that ensues. But we get it because we feel that way. We understand the power of love and loving people. Now, he drags himself, basically, in Source 33. He sits down in the gateway, and when all the troops are told that the king was sitting in the gateway, the troops present themselves to the king. So he drags himself to do his duty, but he certainly doesn't want to. That's not how he's feeling in that moment. In that situation of love versus duty, love versus obligation. All right, narrative 3 deals with Shlomo and Bat Paro. So I have here a bunch of texts from the Psukim, and then I have some of the rabbinic interpretations. I'll sum some of it up. Basically, in the Psukim, in Source 35, you have Vayitzchatem Shlomo et Paro Melech Mitzrayim. Shlomo allied himself by marriage with Paro, king of Egypt. And then you have a bunch of situations where Bat Paro becomes more and more prominent. He builds her a palace. There's interpretations that when he builds the Milo, he takes land that really belongs to Bnei Israel, the lands where they used to camp when they would gather for the Shalosh Regalim, when they would go up to the temple, and he uses that land for Bat Paro. So think about taking something the equivalent of a Central Park type of place in New York that belongs to everybody and saying, I'm going to take that for my own personal private project, right? That's problematic. And then we have a shift over in chapter 11, V'hamelech Shlomo ahav nashim nechriot rabot v'yat bat paro, and so on. He loves the women, right? We went from he's allying himself for political sake to loving. And so we're going to skip forward to a really interesting midrash in Vayikra Rabbah. This is source 41. And according to this midrash in Vayikra Rabbah, Shlomo's wedding feast in celebration of his marriage with the Egyptian princess came on the same day as the consecration of the temple. Now, Seder Olam says that it happened before. Seder Olam says that it actually happened when he began the temple building project. But let's go with this one, right? He goes on the same day as the consecration of the temple. The rejoicing over the king's marriage was greater than over the completion of the temple. As the proverb has it, all pay flattery to the king. Then it was that God conceived the plan of destroying Jerusalem. It was as the prophet spoke, the city has been to me a provocation of mine anger. In the nuptial night, Paro's daughter had her attendants play upon 1,000 different musical instruments which she had brought with her from her home. As each was used, the name of the idol to which it was dedicated was mentioned. The better to hold the king under the spell, she spread above his bed a tapestry cover studded with diamonds and pearls which gleamed and glittered like constellations in the sky. When Shlomo wanted to rise, he saw those stars, he slept in, and the people are plunged into the grief because the Tumid offering couldn't be brought on this morning of the temple dedication because the key lay under Shlomo's pillow. No one dared awaken him. Word was sent to Bathsheba, who woke up her son and rebuked him and basically says, this is not cool. All right, what is going on with this midrash? Did it literally happen? What are we to make of it? So it could have literally happened, but I think that what's really interesting is source 43. Rabbi Alex Israel has an interpretation of a lot of things that happen in the story of Shlomo that have to do with understanding what is going on between Shlomo and the daughter of Paro, because it's very intertwined in the entire fabric of the narrative. As you go through the story, it keeps cropping up. Paro, Paro, Bat Paro, Bat Paro. It doesn't end. So look on page 24, the bolded part. The Medrash presents Shlomo's two loves, his love of the Beit HaMikdash and the love of the daughter of Paro. The two celebrations take place in tandem, in parallel, as if they are equal in weight. Of course, in the Midrashic story, until this point in time, Shlomo had never slept late. He hadn't indulged in wine. In other words, up to this moment, he was a person in control. But from this moment on, he oversleeps, not knowing how to tear himself away from his one love, his wife, to his other love and loyalty, the temple service. And in this text, he is the linchpin. The service depends upon him because he holds the keys. So Bamidbar Rabbah has another medrash that talks about how she introduces 1,000 songs and everyone was commanded before Shlomo that night to listen to them, and she would dedicate the songs to her idols. The songs personify all of Shlomo's 1,000 wives, and her singing demonstrates how the wives lure Shlomo to the world of Avodah Zarah. And we're on this next bolded part on page 25. If Shlomo is described at the opening of the story as marrying Bat Paro, then there may be room to claim that these competing loves struggle and contend for Shlomo's heart from the outset. Shlomo is caught ideologically between competing worlds. Bat Paro represents Egypt, the power and trade, the skills and crafts, wealth, and international control that appeal to Shlomo's imperial mind. Of course, these come along with a religious worldview that is polytheistic and pagan. On the other side is the Torah, the Mikdash, the path of David HaMelech. Shlomo is committed to both. He identifies with each side. He seeks to balance the two, but Shlomo does not know which dance to dance, which party to attend. He tries to mix and combine the two, but he fails. So this is another example. We've got love and we've got duty and obligation. You have love of Bat Paro and everything she represents, that multicultural, exciting world of many opportunities. And then on the other side, you have your obligation to God, to the theocracy that he's supposed to be building for the nation. And again, that obligation can be mixed with love. He loves God as well. But there's one that's kind of his duty if he wants his dynasty to continue. And then there's the other, which is his personal love for his wife and what she represents. So here again, we have a situation where someone is stuck between love and duty. And in Shlomo's case, he's trying to balance them, and they can't balance. It doesn't work. I brought in another text from Ezra here, number 44, to show that Avraham and Yitzchak is not the only example where someone does actually choose obligation and duty over love. We also see it by Ezra. In the story of Ezra, Ezra is trying to get everyone to come back to God. Ezra and Nehemiah try to make everyone make aliyah. So you have in Pasuk 3, he says, let us make a covenant with our God to expel these foreign women and those who have been born to them in accordance with the bidding of the Lord and all who are concerned over the commandments of our God, and let the teaching be obeyed. And if you continue in the rest of Ezra, Perek Yud, you see that as difficult as that was for these individuals who had intermarried, they do end up sending away their foreign wives and their foreign children, and I am sure that must have been incredibly wrenching, and I can't imagine doing it. So, but you see that it's not only in Avraham. You know, there are other people in other places where people do choose their obligation and their responsibilities because of their obligation over love. Okay, let's bring it back to us. How can any of it relate to us? So I think, first of all, simply understanding that this exists is important. To understand that people are torn between duties and obligations on the one hand, and their love, whether it's their personal love for people in their life, whether it's their love for whatever secular culture or other, you know, whatever it may be that's out there, like, people are going to be torn, and that is something we can understand. It shows up in our tradition. It's shown up since the dawn of time. And so we could feel compassion for people if they don't necessarily choose the way that we might hope they choose, because that's a very human battle and a very human emotion, and probably all of us choose one way or the other at one point in time. Also, bringing it back to our pop culture references, we have Jon Snow, who's basically the epitome of this. Jon Snow loves somebody, and then it turns out that, you know, the person he loves might not be good for the realm. And now we have a problem. You know, do I choose the person that I love, or do I choose my obligation to defend the realm? What do I do? How do I pick? How do I choose? And this is something, like I said, that has captured the imaginations of people all over the world, this struggle as it's depicted in these books, in this show, but it's not unique to him. You know, we've seen it in all these different texts that we've looked at today in our own tradition in powerful ways. So I want to end with this excerpt from Out of the Whirlwind by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. This is his book where he talks about suffering, and he talks about how can we engage with suffering. And he comes up with this very interesting idea about dignity and defeat, and this is what he says. If man knows how to take defeat at his own hands in a variety of ways, as the halacha tries to teach us, then he may preserve his dignity even when defeat was not summoned by him, when he faces adversity and disaster and is dislodged from his castles and fortresses. And he looks specifically at the Avraham story, and he says, in the case of Avraham being asked to give up Yitzchak, it was more than a test of loyalty that Avraham had to pass. God the Omniscient knew Avraham's heart. It was rather an exercise in the performing of the dialectical movement, in the art of reversing one's course and withdrawing from something which gave meaning and worth to Abraham's life and work, something which Abraham yearned and prayed for on the lonely days and dreary nights while he kept vigil and waited for the impossible to happen. And when the miraculous event occurred and Abraham emerged as a conqueror, triumphed over nature itself by having a child at the age of 100, the command came through. Surrender Isaac to me. Give him up. Withdraw from your new position of victory and strength to your old humble tent, all enveloped in despair and anxiety, loneliness and gloom. Avraham, take defeat at your own hands. Give up heroically what you acquired heroically. Be a hero in defeat as you were in victory. Avraham obeyed. Which is incredible. Which is incredible, right? Avraham the conqueror, Avraham the victorious, also Avraham who's willing to defeat himself. That's an incredibly difficult thing. So, skipping to page 27, this drama is reenacted continually by the man of halacha. Halacha wants man to be conqueror and also to be defeated. Not defeated by somebody else. Not defeated by a friend. Not defeated by an outside power. Because there's no heroism involved in that. If you lose because people were mightier than you, you were forced to lose. Right? If you lose because your friend, you know, tied your hands behind your back, they tied your hands behind your back. But if you give something up because you chose to do it, because you chose to prioritize your obligation to God, to the halacha, over things that you love, that is a choice that you made. It is an incredibly, incredibly difficult choice. That's a heroic choice, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik. Halacha wants man to be defeated by himself, to take defeat at his own hands, and then reverse the course and start surging forward again and again. And he says, he views this as actually, and this is, he's writing this way back in, I don't know, 1960s, I don't know, this is a long time ago, but he views this as actually important. He says, man is attuned to success. Modern man is a conqueror, but he does not want to see himself defeated. This is the main trouble. Of course, when he encounters evil and the latter triumphs over him and he is defeated, he cannot take it, he does not understand it. However, and this is, I think, the most important thing he says, if man is trained gradually, day by day, to take defeat at his own hands in small matters, in his daily routine, in his habits of eating, in his sex life, in his public life, as a matter of fact, I have developed how this directional movement is applicable to all levels, then I believe when faced with evil and adversity and when he finds himself in crisis, he will manage to bear his problem with dignity. And just to bring it back once more to A Song of Ice and Fire, this is super important for the show because John by birth is one person, and his words would be one set of words, but he's raised in House Stark, and he's raised with the image of a father who's extremely noble and honorable, and as he goes through life, he ends up being on the bottom of the totem pole, constantly either being defeated by others or being defeated by himself, and it helps him so that when it comes to the end and he has to make his choice between love versus obligation, between love versus duty, he's able to choose because of all the things that made him the person that he became along the way. And I think with us too, sometimes we look at halacha, and there's a lot of things in halacha that don't necessarily speak to us, they might not necessarily resonate, they might not make sense. But if in the end we make those choices and we decide we are choosing to do this, you know, I am choosing that I'm going to eat kosher even though I don't understand it, even though I might not want to, even though it's not convenient, and this is a choice that only I can make. I'm in this place, nobody is around me, nobody sees me do it, like, there's no peer pressure, I choose. Then you are, according to the Rav, kind of taking defeat at your own hands. It's a self-defeat. But that's what makes you heroic, because you can do that yourself. You can make that choice for the obligation over the thing that you might desire or you might even love. Thank you very much.